benefit. Just so I know what I say, and you can hold me accountable thereafter, because that's kind of part of what we're talking about here. First of all, I want to thank the organizers. Well, oh, we don't start yet?
1 second.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
So we've asked Dave also to make more general comments about the workshop as a whole. I very much look forward to his reflections also on what we've been talking about in the past 2 days. He has an hour to do so in discussion with us, and after that we have a general discussion. I know that at some point, again, coffee and tea is coming. But what Peter and I will suggest is this: at one point we'll open the doors, and then if you still want coffee or tea, just go get it. But let's continue discussing instead of having another break. Right?
Okay.
Yeah, so now the floor is yours.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I have to say, going to conferences like this is kind of a learning experience for me, because I'm not a historian of funding bodies, but I do think funding bodies are incredibly important. And I realize, as I've been listening to things over the last couple of days, that I come at this issue in a really different way. And so this is going to be, in a way, the way I'm going to begin is giving you my sense of how I get into this topic, because in many respects, I guess I have a somewhat friendlier view of funding bodies, especially external funding bodies, okay, the non-state funding bodies. And how do we get into this? Well, I think let's pick up on this theme of trust, which is another word I don't care much for. I think trust is basically a positive way of talking about something negative. Namely, you don't know, you're not in a position to judge, and so you turn to someone else, you outsource, you offload, and you hope for the best. And that's what creates this relationship of dependency that people associate with trust. I don't see it as a very positive thing. And I think the reason why I want to start on that kind of note is that I think that the best way to see, let's say, something like the Rockefeller Foundation, we could talk about the Rockefeller Foundation as perhaps the paradigm case of a non-state, non-academic funding body who wants to intervene in academic research, but we could also be talking about more military-oriented things. We could talk about, in the United States, we have this thing called DARPA, which surprisingly no one has mentioned here, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which has been very influential in many ways, especially in very kind of avant-garde, high-tech kinds of things. They are the people responsible for virtual reality games used in the military originally, nowadays for drones. They're very interested in creating cyborg soldiers and all the rest of it. Their latest project, by the way, is called the Social Super Collider, which is to come up with some very, very fancy algorithms that would be able to crunch all of the sociological data that's available into one usable form. Okay? So these people think very big, but they're not alone in thinking big. Of course, the Rockefeller Foundation was very much like this. Now the question becomes, why is it that we have these kinds of organizations that start quite clearly from outside the academic sphere wanting to make interventions in academic research? And the short answer is because the academics aren't necessarily the best custodians of what they're producing. So this is the distrust part, okay? This is where the distrust part comes in. In other words, you cannot trust the default patterns of academic research. I think this is kind of the first point to put on the table here. I am somewhat sympathetic to this point of view, at least as a starting premise, because as some of you may know from my earlier work, I'm a big critic of Thomas Kuhn. And Thomas Kuhn, if you think about how he imagines science and how it proceeds on the basis of paradigms, as you know, and paradigms are basically self-organizing research communities. That is to say, the scientists are the ones who dictate what the research agenda is. They dictate everything, actually, right? They dictate the conceptual framework, they dictate the methodology, they dictate what counts as best practice, right? And then they go about solving what needs to be solved within that very highly constrained framework, right? And some paradigms have been enormously successful, and of course, Kuhn's account focuses mainly on the Newtonian paradigm, which was the main way of doing physics for 200 years from the late 17th to the late 19th century. This is the process of normal science. It is this kind of view of science that I would say that the external funding agencies are attacking. Okay? And the reason why universities turn out to be the targets, you might say, for this, is because it is through university institutional structures, especially disciplinary structures, that this kind of normal science is reproduced. Right? And it's reproduced through the teaching processes, right? The way the curriculum is structured. It's also reproduced, by the way, through the way in which academics reward each other normally, through the journal refereeing process, all the internal peer review processes we've been talking about here. So all of this stuff is part of the target, okay? This is part of the stuff that's being distrusted, okay? Now, in this conference, we're focusing on what is it called? Late modernity, right? This sort of shapen thing. But of course, this is modernity all the way through. And in particular, in order to get you into the right mentality for thinking about this, I do think, you know, we need to go back to Francis Bacon and his attitudes to the knowledge production going on at his time in the 17th century. Because in a sense, one way to look at Francis Bacon, who was, of course, the lawyer to King James I and came up with all these schemes for how the state should be involved in the production of knowledge for the national good, is that he saw the default patterns of knowledge at his time, what we would now call scholasticism, as basically falling into a variety of ruts, which include a lot of biases, and some of you may know about his idols of the mind, right? Well, you know, this is like the stuff we talk about now when we talk about biases, right? If you go back to Francis Bacon, you have a look at him, right? And there's the idols of the tribe as well, don't want to leave them out, right? There are all these idols that basically Francis Bacon wants to target with his, what we would now call the scientific method. So the scientific method was this intervention moment for him, where you break the default patterns of knowledge production, okay? And so what is this? Well, he's looking at the early 17th century. He knows about guys like Galileo and Kepler and people like this who are trying to make some headway with alternative forms of knowledge, but they're really not getting anywhere very much by dealing with the academic people who are very closely aligned with the church, that is to say the Catholic Church, okay? And so his view is we need a different approach to knowledge. We need to sort of get at the real core, the real root of things, the causes of things, and the sort of proposals that he puts forward in terms of experimentation and so forth is basically his way of trying to get at this matter, okay? Now, I would use a certain kind of phrase to describe what Bacon was trying to go after here, which I think is also captured by the spirit of these non-academic funders, and I'm going to use the term liberal intervention. This is a resonant phrase in many different arenas. I think for those of you who've heard the phrase before, it normally comes up in the context of misguided American efforts to intervene in the Middle East, where we're emancipating this and that, but just causing more trouble along the way. That's often the way liberal intervention gets used. But I'm actually using it in its original positive sense, and there is a positive sense, and it goes back to the 1930s, and it goes back, in fact, to one of the founders of what we call neoliberalism. And again, I don't know if you know about this man. His name is Alexander Ristoff, with an umlaut on the U. And I'm not going to spend the time trying to find the umlaut here. But this guy was coined this phrase liberal intervention in the 1930s. And what he was trying to get at here was the idea. It was about what the role is for the state in the capitalist economy. Let's operate on the assumption capitalism is the way. It is basically to break up monopolies on a regular basis. Break up the default patterns that bottleneck capital. Right? That's what the state's role is. It's a trust buster. Right? In fact, if we're going to talk about science, we could talk about an epistemic trust buster. So you break the default patterns. And you do this on a regular basis, okay? And this is the kind of thing, this is the spirit in which I think you should be thinking about things like the Rockefeller Foundation and the military-funded research as well, is it's forcing people, in providing incentives for people to sort of reconceptualize how it is they go about doing research. And of course, because they're able to invest a lot of money and put in a lot of additional resources, sometimes creating labs and things like that, they can actually make a big difference. You know, it's like a shock to the system, right? And I think this is the sort of spirit in which one should look at this. And it's interesting when you do, you know, people have been doing, I don't think any of this work has come out in this conference, but some of you may know about this person who published a book last year in the history of philanthropy in the United States, Jane Mayer. I don't know if people have heard of her. Okay. She talks about weaponized philanthropy. And she's talking about the Rockefeller Foundation, of course. Okay? And she's actually quite negative about this, but I tend to believe that you could see a silver lining in any cloud. And so one might want to look at this in a much more positive way as this kind of intervention idea. So part of the story that she's recounting here has to do with the way in which the philanthropic agencies in the United States, like the Rockefeller Foundation, came about in the first place in the early 20th century. And of course it was to avoid paying taxes, right? They were being chased down by the progressive regimes of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, all the great progressives from the early American 20th century. We're chasing down big business like Rockefeller, with the money from oil, of course. But the same thing for Ford, Carnegie, you know, automobile, steel, right? Chasing them all down for taxes. And so there was this agreement that was basically made that basically they could pay their way through the philanthropy, that the philanthropy could be the way in which they're plowing the money back into the society, okay? And they had a very clever way of doing this, and this is where the whole mentality behind the philanthropic agencies came about and why it sat so well with the government. This is the other point, right? Because everybody kind of knew these guys were trying to dodge taxes, but nevertheless, these very progressive governments in the United States were willing to go along with them. And that's an interesting part of the question, okay? And what this has to do was, in fact, the way they were investing the money in, the Rockefeller Foundation, Carnegie Foundation, so forth, was actually to do kind of the same thing the progressives wanted to do. Because one of the things that the progressives were interested in doing, they too were liberal interventionists. They too wanted to shake up the default patterns of the American system, okay? And now the capitalists, the big capitalists, are going to create, as it were, a parallel track for doing exactly the same thing, to reorganize and re-engineer society, because that is what the progressives want to do, okay? And so this became a kind of implicit agreement. And so this is why I think the political ideology of all these interventions that we've been talking about here is so ambiguous, because in a sense, they're very much progressive in a strong sense. In fact, one of the ways you could see this is that already in the 1930s, so 1930s, we're not talking too long after these foundations are established, right? We have the historian Charles Beard. Some of you may know about him, a progressive American historian, talking about the phenomenon of cultural lag. And the way and cultural lag is a phrase that gets coined in the 1920s, and it has a lot to do with the social dislocation that is taking place as a result of all of the innovations that are happening in American society, to a large extent, as a result of stuff being funded by all these foundations, right? So America is changing very rapidly after the end of World War I. And so what's the cultural lag? The cultural lag is people can't cope, right? People have to catch up. And so the way he characterizes it, well, look, the Rockefeller Foundation is creating these disruptions, okay, in various ways, through one set of programs, but then they're trying to address them as well through another set of programs. And this is part of the way in which American society is being radically transformed, largely beyond the will of the American people, right? But in a way that becomes self-accountable, because these philanthropies are basically covering all the projects, both the ones that are creating the disruption and the ones that are going to solve the disruption. Now, from a progressive standpoint, that's kind of okay, especially if you have this kind of long-term visionary sense of radical transformation that I think was very, you know, one of the threads that runs through the progressive movement from Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt to LBJ's Great Society, is that kind of idea of a desire for radical transformation. And in this context, the philanthropists are welcomed fellow travelers. to a large extent. And also because they keep a sufficient distance from the government, right, that the government's fingerprints aren't on this, in case anything goes wrong. And of course, things do go wrong from time to time, okay? So I do think that that's one context. Now, the point about this is that along the way, as all these disruptions are being made, they're not just disruptions to people's lives, it's not just disruptions to the workplace, but it's disruption to the academic order of knowledge, right? So people are given financial incentives to work together in various sorts of interdisciplinary projects that they otherwise would not have, because remember, even if we're talking about the early 20th century, we are talking about universities, even the most elite universities, that are primarily teaching-oriented, and when you have teaching-oriented institutions, this is where you get this disciplinary reproduction stuff going on. This is where you get the stuff that actually ends up forcing you to stay within relatively narrow confines of your activity. Okay? And so, from this standpoint, the interdisciplinary move is also part of the disruption. And of course it has it has long-term effects, because of course a lot of these interdisciplinary fields, one could think about, for example, operations research, cybernetics, molecular biology, there's a whole load of these things that are basically started from private sources that end up becoming very important in the post-war university system, okay? And so there is this kind of, you might say, creative destruction going on of the knowledge production process. And I would say that all of this is quite productive in a way. And in fact, should be welcomed to a certain extent, especially if you look at what the alternative is. In other words, what is it that academics were doing otherwise? I mean, were academics these great kind of beacons of enlightenment and, right, of course not. And the point here is that arguably this is still a problem today, okay? And so in the paper I sent to you, it was a chapter in the latest handbook of the latest Oxford Handbook of Interdisciplinarity. It's a chapter what I call the military-industrial route to interdisciplinarity, and it's basically about what I'm talking about now. One of the things that frames that chapter, two things frame it. One is something that came up a few hours ago in discussing with Emily's paper, and that was this idea of Pasteur's quadrant, which is the thing that I would say the funding agencies, these external funding agencies, really get a grip on. So this is the idea of use-inspired basic research. Use-inspired basic research. And this is modeled on what Louis Pasteur did, right? And this is an idea that was invented by Donald Stokes, who was a program officer, as was mentioned, in the National Science Foundation. And this was inspired by the kind of work that was, in fact, happening from these external funding agencies. So Stokes' book is called Pasteur's Quadrant. It came out, was published by the Brookings Institution in Washington about 20 years ago. Okay, it's worth reading. And if you focus on that, right, then you're going to have a really radically different view about how knowledge ought to be produced, what's worthwhile in knowledge, what your approach to knowledge should be. All of this will be different from the sort of classical ways of basic versus applied, these kinds of dichotomies we normally work with. But the other thing that I focus on in this chapter is the idea of undiscovered public knowledge. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this phrase, okay? This is a phrase from library and information science. It comes from an information scientist in the 1980s, Don Swanson at the University of Chicago. And the idea is basically that, and it's a reflection on something that was already pretty well known with the advent of big science in the 1960s. Some of you may be familiar with Derek DeSola Price, right, who's normally credited with the little science, big science distinction in his book from the early 1960s. And if you remember this book is like one of the founding texts in what we call scientometrics today. And so one of the things that he points to already back then in the 1960s is something along what is known in math is called Pareto's Law, right? That something like 80% of the citations go to 20% of the papers, right? Something like that. It's that kind of an asymmetry. In other words, the vast majority of researchers are just ignored. Nothing's done with their work. And Swanson's hypothesis was because in fact, the way academic disciplines work and the way in which the reward structures work and the way they reproduce themselves is excessively path-dependent. And this goes, again, to the need for radical intervention from time to time, right? So in other words, that how a discipline develops, the paradigm that's anchoring the discipline at a given time ends up determining everything that happens afterwards in the sense of what is counted as relevant, right? So a journal, as you know, will publish several pieces, but only a few of them ever get read very much, and they're usually ones that are talking about things that a lot of people are working on, right? So there's this kind of self-reinforcing effect where, in effect, basically 75% of everything that's published in the journal, however well it may have passed peer review and have quality control checks and everything, is just ignored. Okay? So there's a sense in which the academic community, the way it is currently structured, without any kind of intervention from the outside, underutilizes its own knowledge. Right? This is the point, right? That academia underutilizes its own knowledge. It treats its own people poorly under normal circumstances, which other people get acclimated to. And this, in fact, is one of the reasons why it has been relatively easy for these external funding agencies to take the people out of their normal academic settings and put them in these more interesting, funky settings. Because, in fact, the academic setting isn't doing anything for them. Okay? I think this is pretty damning. And the thing is that this, when I talk about this kind of stuff, I think, let's think about Francis Bacon. He saw this too. Francis Bacon would put it a different way. He was pointing out, look at these scholastics. All they do is comment on each other, right? All the train of knowledge passes through a trail of commentary, and if you're not participating in that, so you think about Galileo and Copernicus and the rest of them, they're not writing commentaries on other medieval commentators, right? You're out of the loop. You're not part of the system, right? And so, in fact, Bacon at one point, and this was something that people in the Enlightenment sort of took up enthusiastically, though without much knowledge, was the idea that the way we should actually divide up academic knowledge should not be by the traditional categories that have been handed down from the Greeks in the Middle Ages, because those are too path-dependent. They don't necessarily represent any natural divisions in the way in which the mind works. What we need are actually categories of knowledge that actually map on directly to the structures of the mind. And of course, the Enlightenment was full of notions of how the mind worked, including phrenology and all the rest of it. But the point was, that was the idea, right? That you would try to come up with this, with an efficient organization of knowledge that maps on to how the mind actually works, which will then enable people to, as it were, know the world in a more efficient manner that actually takes full advantage of the capacities of human beings. Because after all, the way that Bacon and the Enlightenment people, and I would say this is also true of the philanthropists, the way that they're looking at academic knowledge is basically as holding back human potential, right? As constraining people too much. So that even the knowledge that's being produced within the academic culture isn't being taken seriously. And let alone the way in which academics are trained and the kinds of environments in which they're reinforced and rewarded and so forth. So all of this is on the table. Now, one of the things, I mean, let's see how much, I don't want to go on forever, but I'll go on for a few more minutes. One of the things I talk about in this chapter, which again I think you might find interesting, is the way in which university presidents have responded to these kinds of challenges in the 20th century. I just want to draw your attention to two of them, and they're two very famous figures in the United States. One is Robert Maynard Hutchins, who began life as the youngest dean at Yale Law School, 25 years old or something, and then became the youngest president of the University of Chicago by age 30, and a very, very influential figure in American public life. And the other one I want to talk about is James Bryan Conant, who was Thomas Kuhn's great mentor and was the first scientist to be president of Harvard University, and a very important figure. And both of these guys came to grips with what I'm talking about here, but in rather different ways. So they're interesting kind of models to look at, you might say. So Robert Maynard Hutchins, when he was dean of the Yale Law School in the 1920s, so in the period just before the Great Depression, because the Great Depression is going to end up having an important role in his thinking, He was one of the people, he started up, and this is interesting in light of some of the discussions we've been having about decision making and bias and so forth. He started up an interdisciplinary program at the behest of the Rockefeller Foundation, right? So the Rockefeller Foundation comes up to him and says, you know, legal decision making in a complex world needs to be done on a more rational basis. Right? And so what we need is social scientists, we need people from different backgrounds to come up with some kind of model of how legal decision making, should we use juries, for example? Should we use judges, for example? How do we select these people? Right, a lot of issues here. We still have these issues today. Rockefeller Foundation goes to this man, who's this great precocious dean of Yale University, and he says, fine, he lets them in. They do work for a few years, there is this movement in jurisprudence, some of you may know about, called legal realism, which is very much about the integration of social science into judicial decision making. A lot of the people who were part of that at Yale University went on to become Supreme Court justices, and many of them were quite important in the Great Society period of the post-war era. People like William O. Douglas, for example, these sort of liberal kind of people from the FDR, LBJ days, they were people who kind of came through this sort of system, okay? So, for all of his great efforts, Hutchins moves to the University of Chicago, becomes president, then the Great Depression strikes, and he at first brings in the Rockefeller Foundation again. Rockefeller Foundation wants to create social science departments at the University of Chicago, okay? You know, political science, economics, all these kinds of fields. So he brings them in at first. But then, as he sees the Depression taking its toll on America over the course of the 1930s, and his kind of understanding of what it is that has caused all this, he begins to realize that this kind of policy of rapid transformation of society, right, which is very much led by scientists and technocrats and has this very progressive vision, is actually too dislocative. And so he throws all the social scientists out. And if you know something about the University of Chicago thereafter, in the rest of the period that he was the president, because he was the president until 1950, okay, it suddenly gets this very, you know, what should we say, retro-humanist kind of thing to it, right? You know, with Hayek getting brought in and Leo Strauss and, you know, all these kind of people. And people often think about the University of Chicago in that kind of light these days, okay? And so he makes this entire sea change once he comes to the view that the kinds of interventions and disruptions that were being caused by these new fields that the Rockefeller Foundation wanted to sow, the social sciences, were just doing more harm than good. And so one of the people, for example, who flees the University of Chicago during this period is Herbert Simon. And you know something about Herbert Simon, great social scientist, political scientist, wrote the book Administrative Behavior in his later life. He became one of the early advocates of artificial intelligence research, and in fact won the Nobel Prize in economics, right? It was economics, he won the Nobel Prize toward the end of his life, okay? But this is the kind of guy, right, was breaking all the boundaries, challenging all the norms, right? Rockefeller Foundation initially supported, that Hutchins would just not have because it was actually causing too much social disruption. So that's one story. Now we have the story of James Bryan Conant, okay? Now Harvard was in a somewhat different situation because there was basically, in the course of the early 20th century at Harvard, especially once we start to move into the Great Depression period, you get a kind of soft coup of the scientists over the humanists at Harvard. And the person who's behind this, a very influential person, is the biochemist Lawrence Henderson, and he's basically Conant's mentor. Conant was a chemist, okay, and Lawrence Henderson was a biochemist, and Lawrence Henderson did a lot of things, and some of you who are from the field of history of science may know he taught the first history of science courses at Harvard, okay, and a lot of those old guys who were seen as the bulwark staple of Harvard history of science were taught by him at some point early in their careers, okay, and Lawrence Henderson, one of the things that he actually liked about this kind of intervention by corporate culture, you might say, was that it was very strategically oriented. It had a very clear sense of what the goals were, what the targets were, and as a result was able to organize research around it. So Henderson himself, for example, was involved with lots of research having to do with increasing worker productivity and increasing the health of workers and all this kind of stuff. And when Conant became president of Harvard, then he made it easier for people at Harvard to actually interact with these guys, okay, to get grants from them and all the rest of it. And in fact, Conant made it so easy that after World War II, he found himself in a bit of a problem, because one of the things that he wanted to do was to introduce a general education program. Because, see, one of the things that, that Conant had realized was that the way in which, if you want to get a, quote, modern scientific worldview into society, the problem isn't in the first instance with the general public. The problem is with the academics, who still do not think in a properly scientific worldview, even if they are supposedly teaching scientific subjects. Okay, because they don't actually, they're not kind of open enough to be willing to act in the world. And here it's, I think it's worth pointing out that in his time, James Bryan Conant was regarded in the American media, he was another big public intellectual figure, as an action intellectual. That's what he was called, an action intellectual, all right? And so what he wanted to do, what you needed to do was you needed to have a kind of transformation of the academic community and the society, all right? Now the problem was he was a little bit too successful in the sense that it was actually very difficult for him to find proper people to staff his general education program. So the general education program that took place after World War II was basically designed for non-scientists, that is to say, largely, humanists, maybe some people with social science background, arts background, right, to be able to understand the scientific culture they were living in and to understand it in a way that wasn't confined to a discipline, right? So science isn't, you know, what physicists are doing today, but rather to understand the spirit of science, right? And this is where the idea of this is the role that something like the scientific method plays in this argument, right? Because in the kind of argument that I'm talking about here, which goes from Bacon to the Rockefeller Foundation, the scientific method is basically standing here for the spirit, the soul of science. And there was a question as to whether the academic community is the adequate guardian of that. Right? So there's a question about whether the academic community is really an adequate guardian of the scientific method. And so what you want to do is you want to look at cases, right? And this is where the whole case history method that was part of the general education program at Harvard came from. You want to look at cases where the framing of the scientific problems and the approach to the solution of the problems did not have an explicit disciplinary formatting to them, right? And this is where Pasteur is in it. Pasteur is in that. He's one of them, right? As, you know, are all those classic cases you're talking about. And so he would have people read some of the original texts, right, as well as some of the supporting documents. But what they all had in common, and this is one reason why he doesn't go all the way up to the present, is that they would not be the kinds of works where you would need to have technical disciplinary background. You would just have to be able to understand the train of thought that was involved. Because at the end of the day, when you judge what is good science, what you're judging is the train of thought. And remember Warren Weaver from yesterday, right? Trying to find the quality of mind, right? This kind of idea. This is what you're looking for when you're looking for science. And there's a certain sense in which a lot of these private foundations actually understood this better than the academics understood. Okay? So this is part of the issue here that is motivating this drive. And in fact, the term that Conant used was connoisseurship. That the kind of knowledge of science that a non-scientist should have in order to be supportive of science in the right way, that is to say, throw money at it, is connoisseurship. You should be able to know a good project from a bad project. But there's a sense in which that doesn't actually require you to know much of the technical detail. And again, you go back to the way in which we were talking about Weaver and the Rockefeller Foundation and so forth yesterday, right? People were very struck by the fact that you need to know personal qualities, you need to know lots of other things, but you don't actually need to know the technical detail of the work. And this is part of what this general education in science program was about, okay? And this was the program through which Thomas Kuhn, a disenchanted PhD in physics at Harvard, got into the history of science business. It was through this program. He was basically Conant's understudy. So Conant, as you know, was doing all kinds of diplomatic things all over the world. And so when he wasn't there to lecture, there was Kuhn. Okay? And it was on the back of that, of course, a decade or more later, right, that Kuhn put together this book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which in a way gives a kind of overview of the level at which he believed. I think this would be true if Conan and Kuhn disagreed a lot on the details of what the exact nature of science was. I mean, so, but I don't want to go into that. But what I think is most relevant for this, from the standpoint of what we're talking about here, is that Kuhn's characterization of science, very much like Conan's characterization of science in his own public writings, is at a fairly general level, right? Is at a level that doesn't require technical scientific knowledge to understand. Okay? But nevertheless, it gives you a kind of clear picture of what it is. Okay? And so where do we end up with this? Well, there's a lot more to be said, but the point that I want to draw your attention to, that I think is kind of the lesson of the story, is that there is a sense that because these private foundations are not wedded to the path-dependent structures of academic life, okay, there's a sense in which they start off from a certain kind of distance from the day-to-day stuff of academia, from the stuff that we assume to be necessary to be part of the way in which knowledge is produced. And they realize that, in fact, it may not be necessary to the way knowledge is produced. We may not have to be organized around disciplines. There are a lot of other things that we sort of seem to find important and as part of the way in which we, you know, regard ourselves in academic culture that are not necessary for knowledge to be produced in a way that's actually of greatest public benefit. And it's in that spirit, I think, that one should actually welcome these external agents, because it is not at all clear to me that the academic culture by itself could actually reproduce this kind of activity. In other words, I do think that academic culture in its discipline-based structures, insofar as that is a mark of academic self-identity, in other words, you somehow feel you lose who you yourself of who you. Much of our sense of self-identity, I would argue, is tied to the very conservative features that these philanthropic foundations are trying to explode, okay, in the name of actually making knowledge more generally available and more useful and so forth. And that is why historically they have had this very interesting Janus-faced disruptive role, both positive and negative. Shall I stop here? Is that okay for you?
Sure.
Okay, I'll stop here because I don't want to. Because you want. So I'll just take questions, and you want it to be broadened out into larger discussions, right?
Yes, but thanks for this very provocating, inspiring talk, Laura.
Yeah, I just wanted to start off. This is partly a question for clarification. So I understand you, of course, to be focusing and taking the point of focus of the workshop to be on academic research in general. And so I just put a big question mark around that, whether we're thinking about funding bodies. Necessarily talking about funding of academics and what perhaps might be missing in what's not included in.
Oh, but I'm saying the academic research is the enemy. So you're right. Funding bodies are trying to fund more than just academic research. But in that context, there's a kind of opposition being presented from the academic body, from the academic side.
Okay.
That's more the point I'm making.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed the link, or I missed what you make of the fact that this very critique that you're pulling out of Conan, et cetera, mm-hmm. is coming out of academia. So that the anti-disciplinary movement is coming out of academia.
Well, because I think if you look at guys, both Hutchins and Conan realize that the university has to reorient itself in the 20th century. I mean, that's the thing that makes both of those guys very interesting as university presidents. They're modernizers.
So how does that fit with the narrative of academics being disciplinarily
organized? Well, because for both, I mean, again, if you look at the way both of these guys operate, and this is especially true of Conan, a lot of the pushback comes from the disciplines, from the departments, right? I mean, a lot of the reaction is coming at department levels, not wanting all this money coming in, changing the orientation of research, right? Because certain researchers are going to benefit more than others, and it's going to create some kind of disequilibrium.
Okay, so for you, academia equals disciplinary.
Well, what is problematic about academia is disciplinary. I mean, I actually have a positive view that academia can deal with this, but it requires actually separating the future of the university out from the future of disciplines.
Yeah, but
the point is, if you look at the way universities are organized now, and you look at the way in which academics, their own sense of self-identity and so forth, it actually does tend to attach to the parts that are most reactionary, which is the disciplinary formations. So people will identify themselves as I'm a historian, for example, right? That becomes more important than saying they're an academic even.
Enough to be legitimized, to stay in existence. But the debates were actually non-debates, because they were not debates about what is the best type of knowledge, disciplinary or interdisciplinary, but there were always practical things that were made it necessary to saw at the, what do you call that? Practical things that made it necessary to say, well, okay, maybe we should get rid of the interdisciplinary department. So what I would say is that the academia is a locus of the debate between disciplinary and interdisciplinary strands.
Well, that's right, and I would say that these external funders are helping the interdisciplinary side, giving it a certain kind of ballast it might otherwise lack. Because, see, the problem I would say with if you think about the interdisciplinary stuff exclusively within the academy, without the external funding and so forth, you immediately have this problem, which I think, you know, if you think about the fate of cybernetics, for example, which for a while was a big deal, but really doesn't exist anymore as anything within the, as a name it exists. But the point is, there was no reproduction structure, right? Interdisciplinary programs, like you say, they last as long as the students last, but each year you're getting a new batch of students. But what you don't have necessarily is a constant reproduction. And that's why it was very important in the case of molecular biology, which was one of the fields that the Rockefeller Foundation invented, right, that by the 1960s, you actually start to get PhD programs in the field to actually reproduce molecular biology as a discipline. Because in a sense, that's the problem with the university. The only way in which anything interesting survives in a university is through disciplinization, which means reproduction, which means normal science, which means eventually conservatism.
Global social science, whereas when it started, it was quite, you know, quite liberal, oppositional, having history and philosophy accepted as parts of the curriculum, which has all changed. So it was globalized.
Yep. There was another question over here somewhere. Somebody had a question over here when you had your hand up. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think the basic reason is that these funders have practically oriented interests, and it's not clear to them that the disciplines are the appropriate source of the foundation or structures for doing the research. So, I mean, they may be interested in what the economists are doing, but they don't start out saying, I'm interested in economics. They say, I'm interested in the problem of universities as being actually very important, not just because they train people, but because their institutions already in place for teaching and for doing research, maybe not in quite the right way, so they have to inject money. But actually, there are many reasons why the foundations don't always start out by creating research institutes as apart from, completely separate from the universities. It's in part because they actually think the universities do a lot of good things.
Yes.
And many of the people at the Rockefeller Foundation or in the military who were in charge of the research programs actually come from the universities, and they actually value the universities a lot. So.
Yeah, no. Look, first of all, I'm not saying universities are all crap, okay? So let me just take that off the table.
From their point of view, though, even from their point of view,
the
university does do a lot of really good things. So I guess whether they think the universities are sort of the entrenched structures are the enemy, or whether they just see something like untapped potential.
Well, this is the issue. But the point is, I see that as a fairly serious charge against the university. Namely, that the universities aren't capable of fully exploiting their own human capital potential, even in terms of their own literature. So, for example, the way you cast the reason why the external funders, you say, well, you know, they have these problems and they realize universities aren't dealing with it. It's that, right? But also it comes from kind of an understanding of the way in which knowledge is being produced in these fields that ought to be providing answers to these questions, but aren't. Right? So in a sense, they recognize the path dependency of these fields, that they're never going to solve these problems left to their own devices.
Right. Well, I mean, often the external funders are concerned with practical issues in a rapidly changing world, and they don't, I think you're right, they're not convinced that the universities are going to immediately respond to the problems they're
But most of them have long-term strategic visions as well. And in fact, for me, that's the more interesting point. I'm not so much interested in a funder going to a university to get a problem solved tomorrow, but rather this idea of large-scale, long-term strategic visions like the ones that created molecular biology and so forth, where basically, you know, Rockefeller Foundation kind of sees where research is going in various kinds of fields and sees that there are some opportunities there to bring people, the opportunity structure, right, to bring these people working in these different fields together in a more concerted, deliberate fashion. But that requires an external incentive because the university itself is not going to do that as it just continually to reproduce its own disciplinary structures. And I would say molecular biology is a good case in point over the course of a quarter century, right, from the 1930s to the 1950s.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. What you make of the fact that James Conant was the first chairman of the National Science Board.
And I think Conant's a really complex guy, actually, because I think Conant's trying to play both sides of this argument, basically. So, for example, if you look at, of course, as you were pointing out, right, the way the National Science Foundation is organized is very much along disciplinary lines, and he wasn't against that. Okay, because he thought that that was probably the best way to preserve some kind of basic research orientation in the sciences. But at the same time, he was also very open with regard to Harvard University in terms of allowing Rockefeller and all sorts of funders to interact with researchers. So I think he was a guy who believed that, you know, in a way, maybe holding a position close to yours, right, where the university has some strengths that need to be maintained, but also needs to be open to these other external activities. And so here it seems to me that the National Science Foundation, you know, is in a very interesting but somewhat tricky situation, right? Because in terms of, we were talking about earlier, you know, that converging technologies agenda that the NSF put out in 2002, that's something that could have been put out by the Rockefeller Foundation, right? That is like the Rockefeller Foundation kind of program for molecular biology updated. In terms of the way that it's scoped out, there are all these different fields that could be brought together, right? And then we have these long-term goals of increasing people's life expectancies and stuff like that. Very similar to the original Rockefeller molecular biology prospectus back in the 1930s, but this is coming out of NSF. And I think one of the reasons for that, at least, you know, as someone who did some work on this when it first happened, is I think part of what was going on there was a realization that science had to rebrand itself, reorganize itself in a kind of fundamental way, And I think that was what motivated this. But I actually would say that's a really good initiative on the part of the NSF. Yeah. Yes. Everywhere.
But not everywhere, right?
No.
They don't send it everywhere. They send it to the departments
yeah.
where they know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm wondering, I'm persuaded that funding bodies have the capability to play this disruptive role that you were describing. But it seems to me that there are also a lot of examples where funding bodies actually put more money into recreating and reestablishing existing disciplinary structures. They turn the haves into the have mores, or at least.
Well, that's bad. I'm not supporting that idea.
No, I'm not saying you're supporting that idea or that you think it's a good idea. I'm just wondering how that flip side of the coin fits into your framework.
But I just so but that was from the Rockefeller Foundation and through the Ford Foundation, at least up through the 50s, there was a saying, make the peaks higher, and then the idea was that the rest will follow, right? You sort of establish what the highest levels of excellence within the universities, research centers, research projects, individual scholars, and then the rest will be forced to sort of catch up or just constantly fall behind. So that was actually a very conscious strategy. That's how they thought you move the entire system up by making the peaks higher. Whether you agree with that or not, that was what they were doing.
Yeah.
I wonder if we can think more about, so the Rockefeller Foundation official that I applaud most closely is this parasitologist, Harry Miller. Like, I wonder if we can think more about parasitology as an analytic. So one thing that you pointed to in your talk and in the reference to molecular biology I think is valuable here is the success that a lot of funding bodies, not just the Rockefeller Foundation, have at identifying certain concentrations of promising activity and pouring resources into them in a way that makes them take off in ways they might have taken off otherwise, but certainly directs them to take off in ways that fit into a very particular system of credit and patronage and authority. So I wanted to think about it in terms of parasite host relationships, in terms of not necessarily of funding bodies as being especially generative of new areas of research, but as, and this is precisely what we had with social sciences in the NSF this morning, right, of taking sort of existing biases and tendencies and trends and like sort of latent possibilities for research, and by grafting them into a set of opportunity structures, accentuating or pushing them toward extremes.
Yes.
I
agree with that. I actually agree with that picture. I think that is kind of what was going on. Yes, but are you complaining about that?
Well, okay, so my other question for you, right, was methodologically it seems there's something at stake in your account that we should either be sort of praising or complaining. That seems to be a really important motivation for
Well, because I do think what these funding bodies do is kind of force us as academics, we're trying to be reflexive around here, to think about what matters to us, right? Because I do think that if you look at the fact that these funding bodies have had such a decisive impact on the way in which academic research has been produced, often being the source of the most innovative stuff that's gone on, right? You kind of wonder, is this kind of external, why is this external stuff so necessary, right? It seems to me, so in other words, this should cause a certain kind of self-reflection with regard to the default patterns of the way in which academic culture operates. That's kind of what.
In a lot of the talks I had, especially with Laura's talk, that there are huge ethical stakes to. Huge ethical stakes to how we understand the operation of funding bodies, and therefore how we might want to intervene in funding bodies. Is that the direction that we're envisioning, like writing coming or like collective collaboration and writing coming out of this room? Is that a direction that we should? More in our papers is interventions in current funding structures.
It's up to you. You're organizing this, but I do think the interest, to me, what makes these funding bodies interesting is the kinds of interventions they make, on what basis and what their impacts are with regard to especially the working operations of the academic system. At least when I come to this topic, that's kind of what my interest in, and what makes these people interesting is that they make big interventions, and they have big effects.
We have time for two more questions.
What intrigues me is the role of those residents and their motivation, their own motivation, because it might be that they think the intervention of those funding bodies is good for the progress of science in a certain sense, but they can also use that for their own purpose within the organization, I think.
Sure.
Reorganize things, etc.
No,
that's what I stumbled upon in my own research to universities.
Well, see, this is where I think in a way this kind of problem might be mitigated a little bit if universities were a little quicker to actually try to own this stuff as well, rather than treating it as so external to their operations, right? Because I do think, in other words, there's some interesting questions to ask about how universities negotiate contracts and things with getting this external money. What exactly, just how free will the academics be able to be if they're actually taking money from these big foundations? I mean, it seems to me these kinds of there's a lot of interesting room there for some negotiation. I do wonder sometimes whether academics act too weak in that context, right? Because the foundations aren't going to get anything unless the academics agree to it. That's the bottom line. And so in this respect, the academics could perhaps think about what it is they really want out of this that they would find satisfactory, rather than taking this as relatively unwelcomed, which I think sometimes is the case.
More of an observation, I think, I had when listening. I think also the thing that Laura started out to talk with the causal role of funding bodies, the causal position, and explanations we give, I think, to the development of science. That is, we have conceptualized now in different ways, and I think maybe funding bodies probably are have different functions, but here I think you attribute a lot of causal power to these funding bodies.
Yes.
Which is something completely different, and it's also a matter of perspective. This is the perspective also of the funder, that has certain intention and wants to have this causal effect, but we also talked about...
But it's also the time horizon. It's also the time horizon you're looking at, because I think there's a sense in which the power is perhaps more apparent in the longer term.
It is something, then you have a different view of it, as the word, I think that Norty also used, the passage point. Yeah, the passage point is from the perspective of the scientist, right? Not from the funder, so to say. And there of course, you tend to see much less influence from this passage point. Okay, you cannot put a triangle through a square, so to say, but so you have to mend a little bit, and it's completely different. And I was wondering, and it seems to be different from time to time. It seems to be that sometimes there are intentions at play. I think something that Mark already said as well, but we also have to take into account unintended consequences of the proceedings themselves. And it also seems to be, it seems to come back again, I think, to a difference between public and private funding bodies. To some extent, I've seen private funding bodies which have over the last 2 days, attributed much more causal power to some extent.
Yes.
Yeah, I think Timo's talk yesterday as well with finding new disciplines, for example. That was basically the observation. So it was not really a question, but more.
That's okay. That's okay.
I thought in a way that we have different conceptualizations. We don't need to come to one conceptualization of the causal power of funding.
I agree. Yeah.
Well, what I think is important here in this discussion and in the past 2 days is the period we're talking about. We've also discussed whether it's a national or international setting and which country it is. A lot of the papers have focused on the post-World War II era, and I think the interwar decades when funding bodies were also very prominent. Universities were still, 50 years younger, and they hadn't had this huge expansion in the U.S. at least because of World War II. There's a different dynamic between funding bodies and universities in the 1920s and 1930s, and maybe that would change the story a little bit if you would include more of that part of late modern science, not just in this.
particularly well on the period that I have studied, the 20s and 30s. Very steering and the influx of money was so enormous of private funders that you know it's undeniable that they have a lot of influence. But in general, I think in the whole conference, I think post-World War II, it makes a difference.
Yeah, because I think we're also moving into general discussion. So I'm first very much
okay, thank you.